Professor Allen, welcome and thank you for accepting my invitation. I think you don't always get to talk to the authors of the books that you read, so this is a very nice experience. You are a distinguished professor of philosophy and a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, professor at McMaster University. And your work concentrates on the concept of knowledge, which you study from many perspectives. And the occasion of our discussion is a book that has appeared recently, which is titled Empiricisms in the Plural. And the subtitle is Experience and Experiment from Antiquity to the Anthropocene. I want to start with, start at the beginning. I want to start with the introduction where you talk about a cool experiment. I think that's the title of the first section of the introduction. So what was the cool experiment and what was the significance of that experiment? And was that the what led you to write the book? Was that the trigger for the for this book?
The experiment was something that Richard Feynman did. He was already a prominent physicist, had already won the Nobel Prize and worked on the first nuclear weapons. And he was appointed as a member of the commission investigating the Challenger explosion. Everybody else on the commission was a creature of the space program and wasn't really interested in trying to actually find out who was responsible or what was responsible. But Feynman wasn't like that. So he just ignored the other members and went and talked to the engineers and went to NASA and to the Space Center and found out what they were asking. And he discovered that they were concerned with the material that made a certain gasket in the booster rockets. They were in particular afraid that it may fail to function under low temperatures. The launching place was in Florida, so low temperatures were never a problem. But on the day of the Challenger explosion, that was the first time that the shuttle had ever been used when the weather was below zero, was below freezing. In any case, Feynman learned about concerns of cold, and he got the great idea of trying a little experiment, which he did before live television when the commission's hearings were televised. He took a small piece of the gasket, smashed it down in a C-clamp, put it in a glass of ice water for a few seconds, and then released it and showed to everyone that the material lost its resilience. In other words, once he released the clamp, it didn't spring back to form. This is interesting for several reasons. One is because somebody, a philosopher, for example, might say, that's no experiment. Where are the controls? But the fact is that everybody calls it an experiment. Even Feynman called it an experiment. And nobody has ever raised any qualms about this. So that suggests that maybe our notion of experiment as a highly technical operation may be a specialized concept that doesn't automatically equate to simply the concept of experiment. Also, Feynman's little experiment, or if that's what it was very important for organizing the inquiry, because to that point, nobody had any idea what to look at. And the commission was charged with identifying the cause or causes of the explosion. Well, you know, why does anything happen? What's the cause of anything? They could easily have produce some banal report that would make sure that nobody was perfectly innocent and nobody was really to blame. And that's probably what the chair expected. But Feynman cast the whole thing into an uproar because he introduced a whole new problem. Nobody was asking about gaskets. Nobody was asking about weather. It wasn't even part of the evidence until Feynman introduced it. The weather was different on that day. So what I think happened here is that this shows not that experiments prove things. That's the notion philosophers tend to love, this probative notion of experiment. Feynman didn't prove anything. What Feynman did is he said, if you're interested in this big question, what caused the explosion? The only way to that question now has to pass through this little one. What about cold gaskets? So he inserted a question and a problem, and he created the unknown. Before Feynman did this, nobody thought O-ring, the gaskets called O-rings, nobody thought they were unusual. Nobody thought they were a problem. And now, as a result of Feynman's intervention, they became a problem. So he really, his experiment introduced and invented a problem, not a solution. It introduced a new line of inquiry, not a proof of anything. I think that that's a very important lesson to for philosophers, for anyone who's interested in an experiment, to realize that this preoccupation we have with epistemology, as if proving, demonstrating, was the most important thing, is not so. And that's not how experiments work in science. That's not their value in science. Their value in science is more of this opening new lines and creating new questions and showing things that we thought were not a problem were a problem, exposing our own ignorance. That's what experiments do.
Yeah. And that leads you to a distinction between two ways of looking at experiments, and because of this, two forms of two paradigms of empiricism, which you call the theoretic and the problematic. And this is the occasion for making that distinction. Can you explain a bit what that distinction is?
Yes, the terms actually come from Euclid. Euclid distinguished theoretic sciences and problematic sciences. Theoretic sciences, the perfect example would be Euclid's own geometry. They prove theorems, and the theorems that they prove are eternal relations that don't involve constructing anything or don't change in any way by the fact that we happen to know them. Whereas what Euclid called problematic sciences are problematic because they require the construction of something that didn't exist before the problem. And so they construct new existences and bring new things to light. There are many such problems in geometry, like how to double a cube, for example, how to double the volume of a cube. This difference applies, I think, to epistemology, the philosophy of knowledge, because we have two different paradigms in philosophy of how we understand this. One is, for some philosophers, you say empiricism and they immediately think sensations and the proof conferring value of sensation or perception. So that's thinking very theoretically. But other philosophers and certainly scientists think, no, that the real value of experiments is that they show what we need to construct. They show a direction in which we need to move to make something, to construct something, to even if it's just a mode of perception, something that we hadn't seen that we need to look at. They draw to our attention. And this is a conception of empiricism or of experience that's much closer to actual practice in the experimental sciences and isn't dominated by an epistemologist's theoretic concerns with what's the proof, how do we prove it, is it certain?
So all of this thinking about the value of empiria, about our connection with reality through sense experience, is as old as philosophy itself, maybe older than philosophy if we think of canonical philosophy, starting with Socrates and Plato. So can we start the story of empiricism by going all the way back, if you will?
Yes, we have to. Empiricism begins in medicine. It's that simple. Empiricism begins in ancient Greek medicine, and it begins as a reaction to philosophy in medicine. Among the early doctors, the Hippocratics, some of them got quite interested in what was happening in philosophy, and they became interested in the idea of rationalization, of rationality, and they thought that they would make medicine rational. And for them, that meant deducing treatments from theoretical knowledge about conditions and nature. So that was a case of the physicians trying to bring philosophy into medicine. But empiricism arose completely within medicine as a reaction to that, as a way of saying, no, this maybe that rationalism is okay in philosophy. That's not really our business. But in medicine, it's a big mistake. And instead, medicine has to abide by experience, meaning the experience of the physician and colleagues in the treatment and response of diseases to treat.
Yeah, it was probably one of the, sorry to interrupt, it was probably one of the few moments in the history of philosophy where being, I don't remember the Greek term, but being a rationalist was almost like an insult. Like, you're busy with the wrong things, you're looking at the wrong immaterial things. I think it was something with syllogismus or something like that.
Logica.
Logica, yeah, exactly. As if that's a bad thing. But in medicine, according to them, it was a bad thing. And why was it such a bad thing?
Partly because, you know, the Hippocratics had an old motto that our doctors still abide by: do no harm. And if you're just deducing your treatment from a hypothesis about cause, you could do all kinds of harm. But if instead what you're doing and responding to is what your experience has confirmed in the past, you're much less likely to do any harm. You may not cure, but at least you won't harm. Whereas the rationalists are as likely to harm as they are to cure, and couldn't really understand why one thing worked and another didn't. They deduce it from theories that have no basis in medical experience.
And this eventually found some support in the sophistics, in the movement of the sophists, which is also, in a sense, their quarrel with Socrates and later with Plato. There is a form of respect for empirical, slightly disorganized knowledge in Protagoras, for instance, the way we have him portrayed in the dialogue, and he is rejected by the canonical Platonic view of knowledge. So why was Plato then so upset with this approach to gathering knowledge?
Because he thought that the whole world of appearance is just massively disqualified on metaphysical grounds. So it's just, you're still in the cave, you're still trying to predict the shadows. You haven't realized that the truth is totally different from anything you could possibly experience.
And so, I liked one of your descriptions of this. You say, Plato exiled sense perception from the fraternity of thought. I thought that was a very nice way of putting it. And if I may say very briefly, just can we talk a bit about the writing process? Because I think that your books are immensely accessible, even which is saying a lot, because they deal with quite complex things. Do you think about the non-philosophically trained, or is it that you have this natural skill of writing as if it's the simplest thing in the world, but by the time you finish the section, you realize, hey, I understood something that is quite subtle and complex. Can you lead us a bit through your writing process and how you think about the audience?
I don't really think about audience so much as I think about writing. And I don't take my lessons on writing from the academic literature of philosophy. Instead, I simply want to try to write good English that deals with complicated things in a way that's not overtly complicated, that is, which doesn't make it more complicated than it needs to be. So I see it as a challenge. I see clarity of exposition as a challenge that I want to rise to simply as a challenge. Unfortunately, this also means that my books don't look nearly technical enough to the philosophical audience. And, for example, empiricism still hasn't found a reviewer.
But the content is there, right? And that's the only thing that should matter. The same with Artifice and Design and Truth and Philosophy. Doesn't style come as an add-on to content? And if the content is there, then...
Well, that's fine, and I kind of believe that myself, but I just, the evidence suggests that our colleagues don't find that nearly so convincing.
Well, I, for myself, I'd much rather read a book that is written in, let me call it normal English. Although it's not normal because it's difficult to explain things in that simple and clear language. I'd much rather read that than the convoluted sentences of some academic papers. And I strive to teach myself to write in that way, and to not go into bad habits of long sentences or overusing terminology or these kind of anyway. But back to our back to the prehistory of empiricism. All of this, so the debate between, almost like a foreshadowing of the debate between rationalists and empiricists in the 18th century, is synthesized somewhat in Aristotle, who's not quite an empiricist in the Hippocratic sense, but not quite a follower of Plato. How would you describe Aristotle's position in all this, which became so dominant later on?
What you say is correct, but I still think that Aristotle's heart was in theorematic philosophy and theorematic values. And I say that primarily because of the value that he attributes to truth. Truth is not really an empirical value. And in empiricism, many things are much more important than truth. So Aristotle, both of his mother's and father's families were both lines of physicians. He probably had some medical training. In any case, he certainly knew as much about medicine as anybody did in his time. So he knew about empiricism, but he couldn't fit it into philosophy. And that's why you find this funny thing about Aristotle in the scientific treatises. The treatises on plants, on meteors, on atmospheric phenomena, it's empiricism. It's medical empiricism. And none of Aristotle's scientific treatises actually exemplify his own theory of science. When it comes to what's your theory of science, as in De Interpretatione, he hasn't given us one. And Plato's idea of science was completely stillborn. Everybody was dismissing the empiricists as naive and futile and not really knowledge, but none of their other alternative paradigms produced anything, whereas medical empiricism ultimately produced what we think of as modern science.
So it was a bit of cannot live without it, because the practice only validates one philosophy, and that is the one which you do not consider in your theoretical or philosophical works, then you have a problem.
Aristotle really couldn't live without it, because his own scientific research, which obviously captivated him, it would be stillborn with the theory of science. Whereas Plato was not really an experimenter, and he wasn't really, for him metaphysics was knowledge enough. Aristotle didn't really feel that way.
Yeah. I want to say something about this amazing fact that I knew on some level, but I didn't put together in the way you did, which is that many philosophers that we nowadays connect to or with empiricism have some sort of affiliation with the medical profession. Of course, the Hippocratics, but also John Locke, that was his job. William James, so much later they have this connection. And even less well known, for me at least, so for me even more new, was the connection with the, let's call them, legal research in the prima. That's also very interesting that what you do in philosophy or in philosophical terms is very much determined by your sort of day-to-day profession. Because you mentioned that Aristotle was connected to the medical profession, but you said that in an empiricist philosophy, truth is not an important value, at least not in the way it is for Plato. But what are the other values that lead the way, so to speak?
The fecundity of experiments, ingenuity, novelty, fecundity of experiments, that is, finding out finding out enables more finding out. And the really useful finding out is the one that opens up the newest questions. I mentioned, in, for example, going back to Feynman, another thing is concerns the Higgs boson. And there was an enormous effort for years and years to try to confirm this thing. And you know, from a theoretic point of view, when it finally was confirmed, I think it was 2012, you know, that should have been sublime to finally have proved the existence of it. But for working scientists, it was a complete letdown because they had long ago kind of taken it into account and figured out what the implications were. So it didn't advance their questions any. It didn't teach them anything they didn't know. It didn't open up any new lines of inquiry. Steven Weinberg actually said it would have been better for us if the experiment hadn't worked, if Higgs bosons were not confirmed. That would have really opened up some new lines of research.
Yeah, it was. That's. I really love that example because it was so anticlimactic, while being a confirmation of our assumptions or their assumptions in the world of physics. So the fact that we realized that maybe some of our fundamental assumptions about quantum mechanics are true was nice, but they missed the excitement of opening a new door, so to speak, and doing new experiments. Okay, so Aristotle is a natural scientist that happened to write the prior and posterior analytics, which constructed this inconsistency. Maybe it's not inconsistency, but there's a tension there between his works and natural. What happened after Aristotle with this discussion? In antiquity, and maybe moving a bit towards the scientific revolution, towards the next chapter.
Well, of course, Aristotle just so massively dominated the whole rest of European intellectual history, partly through his own, by his own power, and also, of course, through Arabic medicine and the Arabic translation programs. So that anything, I mean, the philosophers were just totally absorbed in Aristotelianism. There really was until nominalism in the 13th, 14th century, there really was no alternative or no wish for an alternative or no sense that that philosophy was trapped. All the action was happening off stage. The new innovations that would ultimately feed into modern science did not emerge in philosophy. They emerged from alchemy. They emerged from new research and interest in things like Albert the Great's research on minerals, and also from law. Law was in a special position because, you know, philosophers, especially Aristotelian or medieval philosophers, they just deduce syllogism after syllogism. And ideally, you know, the conclusion of one syllogism becomes a premise in another, and it's just a chain of syllogisms completely, you know, closed and certain. You can't do that in law. Yeah, you can't assemble evidence. You don't get that kind of evidence. So what you have to do in law is you have to cobble together proofs. You have to take a whole lot of little pieces, no one of which really means a whole lot, and put them together in a way that suddenly has important implications. Now, the lawyers had been doing that ever since ancient Rome, and they had a rather well worked out understanding of probability, of how to enhance probability, of how probability can grow through degrees by further evidence. And it was all worked out in detail and just waiting for somebody to say, you know, it would work in nature too. It would work not just for accusing our neighbors, but for accusing the trees and accusing the water and accusing everything and trying to find out, is it guilty? That is, does it confirm the hypothesis or not? So this was really a terrifically important innovation. Modern science is unthinkable without it. But it's again rooted in something that the philosophers were quite happy to totally ignore for a thousand years.
That was one of my favorite passages in this chapter because, and let me read the, maybe I can give a bit the experience of the The use of evidence in legal thinking drives the development of methods for reasoning under uncertainty. And this is the uncertainty that you described, so that's why. And then you say, almost all the founders of mathematical probability had some connection to the profession of law. Fermat was a lawyer, Cardano and Pascal were sons of lawyers, Huygens was a doctor of laws, Leibniz was a graduate lawyer. Okay, this has to do more with their discussion of probability, but that feeds into eventually into science, because sometimes in science you work with what you later call half-proof, I mean, they call half-proof, which is neither here nor there, neither a fully syllogistically deduced conclusion, nor a premise that has nothing to do with the conclusion. It's in between. It's a half-proof. I think it's actually on the same page, and it's called semi-plena probatio. That's a legal term, yeah. Yeah. So they realize that science is much like law, trying to get knowledge under imperfect conditions.
Yes, and that is, from the point of view of classical philosophy, that's a wild heresy. But if we go back, I mean, Plato and Aristotle didn't write the only books of philosophy. And in particular, there's Democritus and Epicurus. And both of them were had continuity with the medical tradition and introduced elements of what we would now recognize as empiricism into philosophy, so that as soon as some modern thinkers and modern philosophers, as soon as they began to realize that Plato and Aristotle were dead ends from the point of view of empirical philosophy or experimental philosophy, they had this other tradition just waiting for them to pick up, namely, chiefly Epicurus. For example, Epicurus was very widely read in early modern philosophy before Descartes and around Descartes' time. Gassendi is the best example of a philosopher who is really bringing in a profound empiricism that totally ignores Aristotle, but puts Epicurus right at the center of philosophy.
Can you say a few words about the Epicurean version of empiricism, or what their legacy was?
Well, it's theorematic in the sense that, I take that back. Epicurus didn't really value truth. He valued happiness and a good life. So empiricism for him was needed to advance the project of happiness and a good life. The reason we needed it, he thought, was just because human beings were prone to all kinds of superstitions, which made them suffer. And so he thought a good, sensible empiricism would teach us that, you know, the fear of death and all the other superstitions are really pointless, so we shouldn't let them trouble our life. That hedonism, of course, had to be prescinded and made to de-emphasize once we get into an early modern context because of its anti-Christian element. But it proved to be possible to do. And of course, also, you know, Epicurus also, in some ways, Epicurus is ideal for Christianity or for in a Christian context, because he doesn't give nature any power. Nature is just atoms bumping into each other and nothing more. There are no forms. Any laws there may be are just our regularities. So all of nature is just a dead machine, which suits biblical theology fairly well.
Yeah, and so we arrive slowly, although we're moving at breakneck speed, but we arrive slowly in the 17th and 18th century, where the practice of experimenting needed to be sort of discovered by doing. I'm thinking of Galileo, who didn't really have a predecessor. Especially not with that instrument. The instrument was the telescope was new at the time, but also eventually Robert Boyle. What is the? I know it's difficult to sort of try to find the red thread in few words, but what is the common idea regarding empiricism in the time of the scientific revolution? Or maybe we should say experiment now, because these are experimental empiricisms.
Yes, Instead of thinking that the value of experience is to confirm or prove, the new thinking is that the value of experience is to reveal new problems. And more particularly, let me put it differently, the value of experience is to provide an inferential path to the non-experienced or non-experienceable. That's the way that atomism works. Atomists, they didn't just say the world is atoms. They thought that because of certain phenomena which we can experience, distillation of water, evaporation, all kinds of phenomena, that the hypothesis of an unexperienced world of atoms would explain that. So from this problematic point of view, the value of empiricism is to make experience an inferential basis for what we can't experience. So empiricism then can mean two things, as we were saying earlier. It can mean the capacity of a sensation or a perception to prove, which is doubtful, but has been said, or it can mean that the really interesting thing about experience is how it becomes an inferential point for the non-experienceable. It becomes a window onto what we cannot experience. And this has its roots in antiquity, especially in Galen. Galen invented what he called qualified experience. That is not just bare perception, but perceptions made rigorous, perceptions questioned, perceptions interrogated. And then that kind of qualified experience becomes for him the distinctive method of medical philosophy and would eventually become our scientific empiricism. So you've got, even in the 20th century, you've still got, say, Vienna-style empiricists who are basically working with sensation as kind of proof or contribution to proof, together with the truly scientific experimentalists who aren't interested in proof, but are interested in opening up new channels of investigation. And that's what that other kind of empiricism does, is it gives you a license to infer the non-experienced from the experienced, given that you apply canonical methodology.
I want to ask you something more about the book as a whole, or one of the lessons from the book as a whole, because I found it interesting that you mentioned the Vienna Circle here and the fact that they were sort of course there are many differences, but they were dealing with the same theoretic versus problematic nature of empiricism and the function of experience. How do you see, after having written this book, how do you see the notion of progress in philosophy, not in general, but regarding this theme? I was especially struck at one point, I'm sorry, I don't have it in my notes, but at one point you mention one of Galen's, you quote Galen, and you say, well, this could have been said by Carnap in the 20th century. And of course, I recognize it, but I also immediately thought, okay, so then are we running in circle in a certain way? Are we just dealing with the same problem? We're just better at formulating them and publishing books around them. What would you say is, and I'm sorry now, I know I said we're going to talk about just the two chapters, but this is about the book as a whole. What would you say was gained from when Galen was fighting with, with the fight back then until the present day?
Let me speak to this somewhat indirectly. I don't think that philosophy is just moving in circles. I think my research shows about philosophy is that it won't do anything until it gets a hard knock from outside. If it's just philosophers talking to philosophers, they can go in circles for an indefinite period of time, forever, in principle. It's when they get knocked from the outside, I mean, knocked like by physicians saying that maybe this rationalism works in philosophy or maybe it works in metaphysics, but we don't like it. And yet the physicians were doing something. They were, really contributing, which is more than you can say for ancient philosophy. Or again, alchemy. I mean, alchemy, that paradigm of irrationality that every philosopher loves to laugh at. Well, if it wasn't for that alchemy, in particular, say, for Newton's embarrassing preoccupation with alchemy, we wouldn't have Newtonian science.
And I think Boyle was also Boyle was also later
earlier
Boyle was, yeah, earlier was an advocate of alchemy. At one point, he said he saw it with his own eyes or something like that. That something transformed into gold or something. That so it was a continuous preoccupation.
And of course, the thing about alchemy is that this business about gold is really just the tip of the iceberg. And what I think of is more, I mean, the real pregnant influence of alchemy is the instrumentation. Here's where alchemy was really inventing something completely new, is getting a, you know, practically all of the medieval alchemists' inventions, their laboratory inventions, are still laboratory apparatus. And that introduced just a whole new game of Galen-style qualified experience, because now the experience isn't just opening your eyes and having a sensation. It's instead seeing that when you heat this stuff and heat it not just generically, but heat it, say, to a certain point, then it changes in a certain way and other substances don't, and why is that? Those kind of questions, you know, would just had, they weren't even on the horizon in philosophy. And it's only through alchemy that they even, you know, began to get broached. And so that's another example of philosophy really requiring something coming from radically outside before it begins to break out of its routines.
And so this way of in which, let's say, the outside, the hard evidence coming from outside, chisels or the prevents the philosophers from just coming up with insane aberrations. Is this something that that produced, in your view, that led to progress when it comes to our understanding of our relationship to the outside world?
Well, yes, new ideas for sure. I mean, progress is a, you know, people can argue about that word, but new ideas for sure. And without new ideas, there's no progress. Whether the new ideas are progressive is perhaps only for history to say in retrospect. But I think that you're not going to have any progress unless you got change. And so I'm looking at why does philosophy change? If the change turns into progress, really that's a question for the future, to look back and you know, and say whether it was progress or not. But the philosophers are so preoccupied with logic that they miss this point. I mean, logic is, you know, logic can just go on forever. And you can harmonize anything with anything if you're willing to make appropriate, you know, adjustments and compromises. So logic is perfect for just moving in circles. The circles will just internally rearrange, but nothing really different, nothing really changes. Whereas if you bring in alchemy or you bring in Arabic Muslim religion into Europe, that changed a lot of things too. A whole lot of things that had never been considered now have to be considered. So I think that philosophy, much more than we recognize today, philosophy needs these external impacts. And that's why I despair at how philosophy has been colonized by the cult of specialization. It's as if we're making damn sure that nothing external is going to get in, because if it hasn't passed through the sieve of everything that professionally qualifies who can talk about something, then the philosophers just know they don't need to pay attention to it.
Yeah, it's a form of immunization against critique. The layperson is not allowed in the game. So then the knock can never come from outside. It's just a small tip from a fellow philosopher who doesn't agree with this or that assumption that you make. Yeah, which is also why, by the way, I keep bringing that other book, although I don't have a fresh reading of it, but Artifice and Design is also, and Design is also looking at practical things. You talk a lot about bridges in that book. So it's not just about how art and technology relate to each other, but also it keeps an eye on the outside world, the proverbial out of the cave world, and that is also okay. So now to come back to This was unintentional. But now to come back to our scientific revolution and slowly go towards the epistemological empiricism, what was the state of empiricist philosophy as... Yeah, I'm skipping over Thomas Hobbes, of course, but what was the state of empiricism as Thomas Locke found it when he wrote an essay concerning... an essay concerning human understanding? No, that's Hume. A treatise... No. Yeah, that's what I meant. I'm a bit confused with Hume and Locke. So what was the... If we were to look back from Locke's perspective, what was... agreed upon principles of doing empiricist philosophy then?
Well, getting rid of Aristotle, getting an alternative on the table, one that really obliged philosophers to take it seriously. Empiricism was just so easy to dismiss. You know, for a long time, well, I think into the 17th and maybe even the 18th century, the word empiric meant charlatan. And, you know, who wants to describe your philosophy as empiricism with that kind of connotation? So it took a lot of work on the part of Locke, certainly Boyle, to rehabilitate the idea of empiricism. And in particular, it took to show that there was really something substantial that could stand shoulder to shoulder with Aristotle, despite being philosophically totally alien. That was what was required to make the philosophers begin to take empiricism and experience seriously. Although as soon as they did, they treated it theoretically and thought of it as a new way of proving that philosophy hadn't appreciated, which, as you know, I think doesn't really absorb the full lesson of the emergence of empiricism in modern philosophy.
Yeah. So I skipped over... Francis Bacon, of course, and this is maybe it's worth saying a few words, going back and saying a few words, because in his view he had a method to go about doing empirical sciences. He had the new organon, so he was trying in a sense to preemptively meet that kind of criticism that the empirics is just busy with whatever happens, whatever senses experience he has, and his memory, to go back to Galen and that tradition, and is not methodical. The empiricist is not methodical. Well, for Francis Bacon had a method, or at least he thought he had. What was the role of the Baconian science in this development?
Well, Bacon not only had a method, he had the method he had was from lawyers. And it was a method for combining proofs, for seeking out proofs, for being able to discern proofs from mere regularities, a whole logic of the probable brought to bear in natural inquiry. And, you know, it's a to say it had never been done. And Bacon had the perfect combination of, on the one hand, legal training, but on the other hand, also social prestige that, you know, nobody could really just completely, back then, could just ignore Bacon. He was just too prestigious. His reputation, his person itself, made it practically impossible to just sweepingly ignore him. But instead, you had to argue with him. And then once you start that, well, then, you know, already law will have penetrated the field of proof. And a new kind of empiricism is beginning to be practiced. Now, of course, it's routine for philosophers now to go back and find the dumb things that Bacon did, and his method, you know, encouraged some mistakes too. But really, is that a surprise? Somebody trying something totally new and doing a few dumb things along with a few smart things? That's the nature of the beast. And it's absurd to think that he could have just got only right answers. Nobody does.
Yeah. I wanted to, especially with regard to Boyle, and I'm sorry, I keep going back and forth, but we're in that period, more or less, in the modern period. I don't remember what you said in explaining or in answering the previous question, but another thorn in the back of empiricists is that whether we regard something as being evidenced, whether something is a piece of evidence or not, is to some degree a matter of convention. We agree that something is blue, or that under the microscope it has such and such. We agree on how the microscope works. These agreements, especially in the time of Boyle, needed to be sort of, I don't want to say enforced, but needed to be, oh yeah, that's what you said. You said that Francis Bacon had prestige, and so did Robert Boyle, and the practice of doing experiments is something that was sort of amassed through all kinds of conventions and rules, and the Royal Society became something like the place where these rules were certified, and all of a sudden you have a community. So there is still some degree of conventionality to accepting something as evidence, which brings me back to that hard knock from reality. Do we ever get an actual hard knock from reality, or do we, or are we always just...
I didn't say reality. That's your word.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
I said outside.
From the outside.
I said outside, meaning outside philosophy, outside the circuits of university philosophy, the reading that people do. So coming from outside in that sense. But what you say about convention is all quite true. But as I mean something that philosophy hasn't absorbed in its own traditions, coming from outside its own traditions.
Yeah. So the conventionality of regarding something as, let's say, a correct experiment, which changes over time. That's why we said, you know, Francis Bacon had some good ideas and some weird ideas about what an acceptable experiment is. So did Robert Boyle and Hobbes or whatever. The conventionality of the experimental method is not a problem in itself, because it's still an outside, this time the outside of philosophy.
Yes, and I suppose, I mean, it's probably a fool's errand to think you can really separate nature and convention so dichotomously, that all of our nature is saturated with conventions and all our conventions interact with nature. Any technology is, you know, any tool, any instrument, is obviously partly a natural functioning, but it's also, there's some convention. For example, we trust it. That's a convention. We have rules for using it, which, I mean, it could be used in other ways and so on. So I think we really have to, we can't persist in a dichotomous treatment of nature and convention. Instead, we have to understand that they completely interpenetrate and that this, moreover, is required for knowledge.
Yeah, I don't know if this is a common practice, but if I'm thinking of one of my recent papers where I'm trying to say that technology is a bit like a Leviathan, in that there's a value trade-off involved all the time, and we accept it. There's some, just as the Leviathan takes a bit of freedom and gives you security and all that, every technology comes with some sort of drawback. And sometimes it's minimal. We would have to think really hard to imagine what the drawback of a table is or a chair. But this Leviathan character of emerging technologies is very obvious. AI comes with positive aspects as well as negative aspects. So all this means that technology is in fact like a contract. Although it has its natural, of course, it affects the natural world, and you can do stuff with it. You can, you know, use a hammer to hit the nail, but it's like a contract. It's give me some value and limit yourself in respect to other values at the same time. Is this what you mean by the conventionality of it?
Yes. Although we at least in the American European tradition tend to be quick to assume good things and slow for bad things. I'm thinking of particularly that chemical, the name escapes me, that destroys the ozone layer. That's now CFCs.
Yeah.
CFCs, you know, their inventor was so proud of them. And he even had a party trick where he would spray some CFC into his mouth and then blow out a candle. So it proved that it's not flammable and not poisonous. But he didn't really ask probing questions about its physiology, about its effect on living systems. And instead, he just said, see, it's okay, so let it into the world, and then we pay the price. So the search for consequences is often given short shrift, especially if there's money to be made.
There's something with inventors that they are doing it on themselves. I'm thinking of also the American inventor, I think his name was Midgley something, Thomas Midgley, who invented the leaded gasoline. It was tetraethyl lead. And he put, there was the same. It was like a press conference back in the 30s.
It was the same man. It's the same man.
What? Really?
The same man. The same man invented leaded gasoline and CFCs.
Oh,
yes, he did. He had a greater
effect. Yeah, because it was the thing with the fridge that they put in the fridge, the Freon. Yeah, okay, I know. Okay, yeah, yeah. Okay, so then it was just one guy that was doing these things, yeah.
But one guy who had a greater effect on the planetary ecology than any other individual.
Yeah, yeah, that's funny. I didn't realize it was the same person. I don't know them as CFC. I think Freon. Also in Romanian, we used to. There was a big time in Romania, sorry, where everybody had to, because we still had fridges with Freon, and everybody was like, oh, you have to change your Freon because it's bad for it. So everybody was buying new fridges, and you know, the story came up because you find out why, and then you learn about these things. I don't know what happened with the CFC, but after his little Feynman moment with the experiment, he actually had to take leave because he got intoxicated, had lead poisoning after that. So the thing didn't go well for him. Anyway, we're approaching the end. So maybe I will formulate more general questions. But again, without necessarily covering the whole book, I would like to know what you think about the whole rationalism versus empiricism nowadays. I mean, this is still taught in philosophy courses, and to be honest, that's how I started the series, because I think you have to know about it, at least historically, what those mean, and you know, a priori and a posteriori and synthetic and analytic. I talk about them in a historical context, but is it still valued, is there still valuable to talk in these terms, to see philosophy as this big battle between rationalism and empiricism?
Yes, I very much think so. I think that it's only rationalists who think that empiricism no longer needs to be talked about, and we can all just relax and be rational about it. I think that the difference between rationalism and empiricism is still ought to be a major threat in philosophy. I'm not saying it is, I'm saying it should be, because philosophers are just way too addicted to rationalism. It's not passé. We haven't gone beyond it. So I think that empiricism remains important as this check on the pretensions of rationalism in philosophy. Empiricism remains important as this teaching the lesson that philosophy grows through the influence of the outside. Again, meaning I don't mean sensations. I mean not philosophy, not arguments, not logic, but the innovations that are the substance of history and of historical change. That the philosophy needs these to remain vital. Rationalism, as I think of it, would shut them out if it could, would close all the windows, because then it would be so much more logical. So I think that is still something that philosophers, that our peers are still, many of them, addicted to, aspire to, believe in, and which empiricism, as I understand it, is a challenge to that, and it remains an important challenge.
Yeah. But do you mean it more as in their attitude towards towards work, so to speak, and towards what they write and how they write? Because I don't know a lot of my peers that would describe themselves as Kantians, or you know, they believe in the rationalism of Spinoza or Leibniz. They're not rationalists in that sense. There are not that many out there nowadays. But what you're saying is, if I understood correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that they're rationalists at least in their contact with the outside world, in that they tend to avoid it.
Yes, and also the prestige of logic and the prestige of the a priori. Maybe they're not, you know, rationalists like in the 17th century sense, but it's still, you can still get philosophers to get their eyes quite bright and their blood pressure up by the prospect of a possible a priori. Logic just guarantees internal reference. Logic makes internal reference consistent. That's its work, that's its value. And I'm not saying it hasn't no value. I'm saying that it cannot be the only value. And in particular, that really it's truly, I would say it's secondary. Secondary to change, secondary to innovation, secondary to the work of thinking, of advancing thought. Logic just makes it more consistent, more internally consistent, even maybe simpler, but it doesn't really advance it in the sense of bringing in new ideas.
Yeah.
Whereas empiricism is dedicated to that.
I come from an area of study that is called, in Canada, is mostly known as informal logic, and this turn against logic in a sense inspired me to go towards where I am now. And in Europe, we don't use the term informal logic. We also don't really use the term critical thinking, except maybe outside academia. We talk about argumentation and argumentation theory. And the fact that somehow you should strive for some type of logic is something that I see indeed among my peers. Even, for instance, search and destroy type of search for fallacies. When I studied my master's at the University of Amsterdam, fallacies were all the rage, because you can it's a rationalist impulse to dismiss in that way and know about the many labels and to be that kind of critical person. But ask them, how the engine of a car works. I know this is a stupid example, but that type of knowledge is irrelevant for knowing what a fallacy is and accusing someone of having committed a fallacy.
Yes, I'm not familiar with your work before we had this chance to meet, but both of the areas where I understand you to work, what we in Canada call informal logic, but also history of science, history of technology, these fields thrive on that external that I've been emphasizing. And that's why they, why the philosophers, I'm sure you can probably still find philosophers who are a little nervous about this history of science stuff. I mean, it's all very fine as history, but in philosophy, how the dialectic unfolds, but it's an example of the history of technology, history of science, theory of fallacies, critical thinking are good examples of saying philosophy needs more than just philosophy. That philosophy grows through the assimilation of what wasn't philosophy.
Professor Allen, if you never ever write a book again, I think you can be extremely happy with what you've produced. However, I'll be audacious and ask you what your plans are for the future.
Well, I don't know if you may know that I have a new book, just 2023, on Bergson. Bergson was a big discovery for me. You know, Anglophone philosophy has just laughed and joked about Bergson ever since he lived. And he's really, I think, he's a very deep philosopher. And Anglophone philosophy would be much stronger if we understood that. So that was one project, but now done. My more current things that are just real research are two. One involves trying to understand a relationship between classical Western philosophy and the indigenous culture and history of indigenous North America, I mean Indians. And what kind of interaction there is between those two, or can be between those two. And also I'm working, and for example, my graduate seminar just now is on a theme of what I call philosophical ecology. I think I got that word from Bruno Latour. I'm not sure, but Bruno Latour is certainly a central example of what I mean by philosophical ecology. We have a tradition in Anglophone philosophy of thinking about ecology, but it tends to be, in my opinion, not really very philosophical and rather kind of stuck and not saying anything that, I mean, this repeating Heidegger, for example, has been enormously influential in this respect. And with Heidegger, you know, all you can do is really just basically repeat him. You can't build on him. You can't, he doesn't open up questions. All you can do is, you just spend all your time trying to explain his bizarre language. But what I'm calling philosophical ecology opens up Anglophone philosophical thought to people like Latour, Michel Serre, Isabel Stenger, to Deleuze and Guattari. And I want to bring those ideas into what Anglophone philosophy can say about the earth and questions of ecology.
That's so. Let me ask you first: do you have like documentation regarding the first project? Because my first worry would be that's a super interesting topic, but where would I ever get anything about philosophical thinking of the indigenous people?
Yes, I've got a paper in Episteme. I don't have the detail, but it's within the last couple of years on, I forget even the title, but it's Philosophy and Native American Thought. So if you look in Episteme, which is a pretty good analytic journal, if you look back, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, you'll find it. And also I've been able to publish from the other side. I've got a paper that's going to be appearing in the American Indian Quarterly. And that's important to me because I want to try to open up a conversation that has been resisted for a long time. And in particular, the American Indian Quarterly does not publish work by white guys like me very often. So I'm trying to say to official philosophy like Episteme that there's a topic here of indigenous thought and culture, but also to say to indigenous scholars that there may be a relation with philosophy that can be pursued without the many problems and unhappiness that has characterized that relation to this point.
Yeah, and that is also, from what I hear, your plan with, it's not a plan anymore, it's completed, but that's also what you did with Bergson. Is this your signature move that you find unvisited corners, and if it's some added value, you bring it to light, so to speak, and you're a seeker for undiscovered sort of treasure hunt?
Well, that may be so, and if so, then I pay the price because most people just say what is it? It's nothing. We've seen it, or we don't want to see it, or it doesn't make me friends. But it keeps me busy.
Yeah. Well, I can, again, I know this is very personal, of course, but I can fully recommend your books. Definitely Artifice and Design is something that anybody can pick up and read because it touches upon things that we seem to or think we understand in everyday life. And of course, more historically oriented truth and philosophy, and of course, empiricisms. I am very excited about our resulting discussion, and I have to say I was very nervous in the beginning. Well, maybe not very nervous, but I was nervous in the beginning, but you're an excellent discussion partner. So thank you very much, Professor Allen, and hopefully we'll interact again in the future.
Well, thank you very much. I'm grateful for your interest.